Good evening. This is Ray Hill. We have technical difficulties tonight. Mario Swain is a prisoner. If Texas, the state of Texas, has its way by the end of this show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Swain by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the 251st killing by this governor, Rick Perry. Execution host Ray Hill, myself, legal analyst Jim Skelton, defense attorney Susan Ashley, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Ruback, and Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. Special interview guests will be Joanna Steinberg, assistant counsel for the defense justice practice of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund in New York. Execution Watch for Mario Swain begins. And we don't have any music either. So, all right, Jim, what happened in this case?
What happened in this case, pretty simple. What happened is that Swain had lived in California and moved to Longview, Texas, was living there. And he's burglarizing the house of a 46-year-old woman with the name of Lula Nixon. She caught him during the burglary, and he ended up killing her. And after the killing, they tracked him down using information for pickup and that is parked outside the house. And after they tracked him down, he gave a series of confessions and was convicted. So it's pretty simple. He's a first-time offender, at least the first time he been caught with anything. But it was a burglary, a murder during the course of a burglary, and that's what happened.
So there's not much question about guilt or innocence?
No, he ended up. There's something like, and Mike Gillespie was going to discuss that, but he ended up giving three different statements, incriminating himself. The final one, he finally admitted doing all the killing and by himself. So there's no question about guilt, because really the only issue in this case was punishment, and they had some pretty bad evidence coming out at punishment, too.
What do you think they said during continuing dangerousness?
Well, I think I've asked Susan Ashley to look at the continuing dangerous part, and the reason I asked her to do it, because most of the people who testified would seem like an all-female brigade that testified against him at punishment, and I think I asked Susan to discuss that.
What do you think, Susan?
Okay, what happens at punishment is there's a number of women who testify against him. First, there's a couple...
Wait a minute, before you get into that, I think we've got Gloria on the line. Gloria? Gloria?
Hey, Ray.
It's a technical mess here tonight. What's going on there?
It's an execution mess. The media has walked across the street from the prison administration building into the death house. Nobody else has come across, unless I missed it. It's actually dark here in Huntsville. But it doesn't seem to be that there's any family witnesses for Mario Swain.
Do you know where Mario came from? Well, we just lost Gloria. Gloria? Gloria? Yep, we lost Gloria. We are having a myriad of technical problems tonight, and I apologize to you who are listening to this live.
And
or
that's
by
your
tape.
Question. He was from California.
He's from California.
He was in California.
So he may not have any relatives to show.
From what I've been able to read, Ray, that he lived in California, and it doesn't say in any of the opinions when he ended up in Longview, but most of his life apparently he's living in California as a young man, so I would imagine most of his family lives in California.
Okay. As soon as they get Gloria back, we'll put her on the air, but they haven't managed to do that. I'm sorry, Susan. We'll continue with you. Apparently, this operation is in operation. The media crosses the road. For those of you who are listening the first time, that is the first indication we here in the studio have that there's actually going to be an execution. It's when the media crosses the road, and that is usually followed by family witnesses for the person being executed. And so they have crossed the road. The process begins with that action. The witnesses for for the victims of the case, they have a right to attend this as well. They come in by a different means, and they are not seen crossing the road, but the witnesses for the defendant and the media would come in this way, and the media has crossed the road. So, Susan, what happened? Well, what happened the whole trial? Was there any evidence presented of extenuating circumstances? We've got two things on the table, extenuating circumstances and continued dangerousness. What say?
Well, in the punishment stage of the trial, a number of women testified against him. There were two women who testified to the incident. The MO in the incident was almost the same in both cases. Essentially, it was that he hid in the backseat of a car, had disabled the dome light of the car, and when the woman came and got a new car, that he attacked her with a stun gun.
So he was waiting in the car when she came to the car.
Correct. And attacked the woman with a stun gun, I guess disabled her for a while. First woman who testified to that effect, she later got away from him. There was a second woman who testified to basically the same thing, that he hid in the back of the car, had disabled the dome light, and used a stun gun to disable her. Both of those were in 1999. Then another woman who had been a girlfriend of his also testified against him. And what she testified to was that he wanted her to go to the knock on the door of a woman's home and essentially find out who was home, who was present at the house, and ask the woman if she could use the phone.
So they did have some evidence to present during the punishment phrase,
yes,
that indicated a pattern of behavior. I'm going to go back to Gloria. She's about Gloria. Gloria.
Anyway, as I was saying, the media went in, but I do not believe any family or friends have gone in. So I guess this is going to be a rare execution. And I hear you all talking about the facts of the crime. That's been rehashed in the paper a lot. But I think the important thing about this execution is it's going to put Texas 10 away from 500
total
executions, which is something incredibly disgusting. But I do want to say that I think that the people on death row who are listening, we're on live, right?
Yeah.
And
broadcast. So they're hearing us.
Anybody that's listening anywhere in the world should know a couple of things. Not only is Texas and Rick Perry setting milestones, but executions are down, death sentences are down, and I think that the support for the death penalty is definitely waning. There was an incredible march and rally in Austin this week that was so touching because so many death row families spoke. And Paul Story, you should be so proud of your mother. And Jeff Dean, you should be proud of your daughter and your nephews and your sister. And I'm trying to think of who else spoke. For so many family members, it was just really, really touching. It was touching to see Jeff Wood's daughter, who just turned 18, who's really lived almost her whole life without her dad. And he's a victim of the law parties. He didn't even kill anybody.
Did you have a pretty good turnout in Austin?
Yeah, I'm thinking maybe 400. I don't know if anybody gave an official count.
Well, that sounds very encouraging to have that many. Gloria, I understand you also have an author there?
Yes, we do. He wrote a book called Meals to Die For.
Oh, that's
and
what,
I'll let you talk to him
sure.
in just one moment.
Hi, Ray.
Haven't seen you since you were on the prison show some time ago.
Oh, this ain't Ray, is it?
It sure is. How you doing?
How you been, bro? Man, no, it's been a long, long time.
Yeah.
Well, we're still kicking. Nita and I are still up in Crockett. I closed my restaurant just a few months back and fixed to reopen one up in downtown Crockett here real soon. But, man, it's great to hear from you. Man, oh, man.
Well, be sure and send me that address because it's been a while since I had some good cooking. You know, I eat in cafes all the time, and most of that ain't worth the time.
Oh, man, I've got the reputation for the best one all the way up in Houston County, brother. I've really made a name for myself that way.
Well, you sure have, and we've been hearing good things about the book. Every once in a while, it'll come up in conversation of folks that heard your interview on the prison show, and we all wish you well.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, I'd love to come down and see you guys again. I've got an agent now out in California, Los Angeles, can really hook me up with some good things. We're trying to get my own cooking show out that way.
Well, if you pass this way, give me fair warning, and we'll coffee up.
Yeah, that's awesome. Ray, it's great to hear from you. I'll tell Nita that I got to talk to you, man.
Okay. Thank you, bro. I'm going to move on because I got another reporter from a vigil site. You keep Gloria company until this is over.
Going to do just that. I'm trying to get the last meal request reinstated.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your efforts.
Love you, brother. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Dave, this is Ray Hill.
Hi, Ray.
You're on the air.
Good, good. Well, we're out here at the corner of Almeda and Holcomb again. Got about 9 people tonight. A lot of cars passing this corner. And so we're doing our thing out here again. You know, we moved this vigil around 4 places in Houston. And this is the one that we are out at for October, November, and December. Then we'll be at another location. But it's a good location because there's just, you know, hundreds of cars that come by here.
Okay, listen.
And let me mention something. I don't know if anybody else has mentioned it, but I want to mention this program that GRACE, the Gulf Resources Advocacy Center, is having starting next week. And they're having a number of events. I'll put out more information on the Internet on it, but they're going to have Sister Helen Prejean in town, plus a number of other people. On next Wednesday, I think it is, the 15th. And then on the weekend, they're going to have a big event to raise. It's all for fundraising for GRACE. I think Steve Earle's going to be there on Saturday night, along with Mike Farrell. And, you know, that's a very, very worthwhile organization to support because they're the ones that will get in there and defend somebody who's poor and doesn't have a lot of money, who's accused of murder. And that's,
well, I don't know if anybody whose execution we cover here has a lot of money. That's
well, that's the
nature of this show.
Right. One of the best ways to drive down executions is to make sure somebody doesn't get on death row in the first place.
That's true.
And so that's what GRACE does, and they do a good job at it. They've got a bunch of dedicated people over there, people should watch, and Ray, I think you'll get this information when it's sent out on email, too.
Yeah, I'll broadcast it on my personal media. Well, I'll give you a heads up on something. I got a call from Robert Perkins and Robert Chase. You know who they are. Robert Perkins, University of Hawaii. And Robert,
right, the guy that wrote the
Texas
book.
Tough. Texas Tough is the book.
That's a great book.
And Robert Chase, who is now with the University in Maryland, and they are planning a national march on Washington. This is very embryonic, but in order to pull something like that, we need all the cooks and the bottle washers and everybody else. So heads up on that, and give our regards to the other vigilants there, and I suspect this process has begun, and it will process through. I wish I had better news.
Okay, all right, Ray, you take care.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Well, that brings us back to the studio. And, Susan, you finally get to complete your description of what happened.
Okay. Well, at the punishment phase, a female friend testified against him. Basically, what she testified to, that she was driving around with him. He wanted her to go knock on the door of a home and basically check out the home, see who was home and so forth, and ask the woman who answered the door if she could use her phone. The woman basically pretended that she knocked on the door, pretended she talked to the woman, and came back and said that the woman did not have a phone. Also, the same woman who was a friend of his also testified that they were in the car together, and on another occasion that a female had gone to a gas station, left her car running, and that Swain wanted her to take the car and knock the woman out if she came back. But the female friend refused to do that.
But there were no charges in any of these cases.
None of this was processed.
Well, apparently what happened, they didn't find out about these other offenses after he was charged with this case. When I read the opinion, my impression was that they had these unsolved offenses. He had not been identified in any of these cases before. No cases had been filed. So when they filed,
in other words, if there's somebody sitting waiting to be tried for murder, mm-hmm. and they've got a conviction, and it's now the punishment phase, mm-hmm. I can waltz into that courtroom, make up anything I want to, and it get admitted?
The way it works is quite simple. They will permit you, and it's even crazier than that, Ray. It's even more extreme than what you're saying. If it's an unadjudicated defense, they can put the evidence on, then try you again for that unadjudicated defense and convict you a second time. But even worse than that, there have been instances where people have been acquitted of cases, and they still brought the complaining witness over and testified even after an acquittal took place and the person was found not guilty. There was a case out of Dallas in which a man had been charged with murder and had been no-billed. At his punishment hearing, they introduced not only the fact that he was charged with murder, but including all the murder photographs after he'd been no-billed. So here's what they can do at a punishment hearing. Since the issue is future dangerousness, any unadjudicated defense, so if somebody is arrested and they have unsolved cases.
Yeah, but
cases,
in these cases, nobody was arrested.
Well, I said, if no one, actually, someone, he's been arrested for this offense, and then they have unsolved cases, and he matches the description of the person that did the or these prior crimes, they'll bring these people in. I think they identified once, I think, by DNA, if I'm not mistaken. Another one, they tied, it wasn't just their testimony, I think DNA tied one of them in, and one of them made a positive ID, but you're exactly right. If you want to walk in and say that if I was on trial for murder and I got convicted, and you want to walk in at a punishment hearing, so will he rob me too? And if they believe you, they can convict me. If not convict me, they'll
use us. You know that documentary, Thin Blue Line, guy out of Dallas.
Right.
And spent many years on death row, right, until some documentary worker, wasn't even a lawyer, that fished out the fire. In his case, there was a guy, a throwdown witness, I can't think of a better word for it, in Dallas, that had been an eyewitness to three different police shootings.
Well, it also got the death penalty later and was executed. The same throwdown witness.
That witness got...
Yes, sirree. Because that witness had been involved in some murders before from Beaumont, as a matter of fact, and he was later executed.
Oh, well, that gives him plenty of motivation to testify.
Because if you recall when they filmed the Thin Blue Line, they interviewed, and he was on death row when they interviewed him. Because the witness that we're using, I mean, he went on death row when he testified.
Yeah.
But when they did the film, by that time, he'd killed somebody. What they'd done, he killed a guy here in the burglar here in Houston. And he was on
death row. I'm not the kind of guy that did it. I'm talking about the eyewitness in his trial.
I'm talking about the witness who, the juvenile who was with, the gentleman in the Thin Blue Line, who was accused of killing the cop.
Yeah.
Who the state used as a witness.
Yeah.
Ended up on death row.
Yeah.
Ended up being executed. Out of a bone, and he was from Beaumont.
No, there was another witness. There was a black guy in that was a throwdown witness for the state. And come to find it out, he had been eyewitnesses
in a bunch
to
of cases.
Three police killings.
Oh, yeah.
Now, how the hell do you know where those police killings are going to happen so you can get your ass over there and witness it? This was, and he was apparently being well compensated for all of that.
Well, this isn't a death penalty deal, but I'll tell you one that just outraged me. There was a deal here, and I had to defend one of the guys. There was a deal here in town where they had a guy who was a member of the Texas Syndicate, and they wanted a bunch of those guys on parole to be in jail. And what he did, say that I knew you real well, I've been in the pen with you. I'd go to you and say, Ray, I've got this gun I'm going to sell to Susan Ashley, but I owe her some money. And if I sell the gun to her, she's going to want her money back. What I'm going to do is give you the gun, and when Susan comes to pay it, I'll give you a split. And then what I did is turn you into the cops, and I got a reward
for selling
the gun. And I got a reward for it. He's making a pretty good living setting people up. He made like 10 cases like that.
All right, we're going to call a recess here, and we're going to talk to Johanna Steinberg. And so I'm going to put her on, and we'll be back in the studio to talk about some more about this case. This case gets thicker every time I look at it. Ms. Steinberg, are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Well, welcome to the Execution Watch show. Every time Texas kills somebody, we go on the air and we try our best to describe that case. But it gives us an unusual opportunity to look into the process of execution, trials, and punishments. I take it that you do some of those things for the NAACP.
We do. In fact, I work as an attorney in our criminal justice project, and the issue, particularly of race in the death penalty, has been one of the core issues here at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund since our inception. It's something that the late Justice Marshall and his lawyers represented countless people, African-American men who faced execution in the Jim Crow South, and it's been and remained a priority for us.
Them's big shoes to try to fill, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. We can only do our best to try and work in his honor and in his spirit.
Well, do you do this all over the country, or are you territorial in some way?
The Legal Defense Fund, we have cases in various states. We aren't limited to particular states, but obviously we are limited in resources. But we do take cases. All of our cases do have some issue of race, often in discrimination in jury selection and that type of issue. And obviously a lot of our cases are in the South.
Is it as crazy elsewhere as it appears to be in Texas?
In some ways, yes, in some ways, no. I think the issues that we work on are issues that affect people accused and people in the on death row throughout the country. Certainly, Texas is in some ways unique in that regard. But I think that, you know, if you look at the history of the death penalty, it's important to also consider it in the historical context of lynchings in this country, and particularly in the South, because in many ways, lynchings were the predecessor to our modern-day capital punishment system. And there's many similarities, including in this case, where you have black defendants, a white victim, a essentially white court system, and, you know, all or close to an all-white jury. And Texas, in some ways, you know, Gloria, I think it was Gloria who mentioned earlier in the show that tonight will be the 490th execution in Texas history since it began. Yeah, and that, I think, is particularly, you know...
Since Charlie Brooks, because I covered that case on a different show, the execution of Charlie Brooks, and that was the first case after
Furman versus Furman.
That number, you know, is independently disturbing. Another number to compare it to is that in the, you know, maybe 85 or so years before the death penalty was abolished, when between, you know, the late kind of mid to late 1800s going forward, in Texas there were 493 recorded lynchings. And so Texas is now at a place where in half the time it has executed almost the same amount of people that were lynched in its history. And I think that, you know, that history is in, you know, is a history of this country, but also a history in Texas, because I think that what you see is that states that had high numbers of lynchings of African Americans sometimes have, or often have, some of the most active capital documents.
Yeah, well, while you're there, let me bring up a little bibliography for our listeners. Robert Perkins' Texas Tough, which you mentioned earlier in the show, is an important book about the history of the evolution of Texas prisons after the Civil War and the culture. And Jane Bernstein's Story of the Last Lynching in Waco, Texas is an important book to look. You'll have to find that by author, because I don't know, remember the name of the book. And then, of course, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. It goes back through that history, so listeners can look up those things. And why is it important for people to study that history?
I think it's important as we understand the role that race continues to play in the modern death penalty system. We talk about kind of these individual claims and individual statistics, but I think it's hard. If you look, for example, at Mr. Swain's case, you have a snapshot of what of kind of numerical things that are happening or arguments about race. And, you know, the times have changed, and there's certainly been we've made significant progress in race relations in this country, and certainly there are improvement in explicit and overt bias in the way that we talk about things overtly. But we see in the current system that the implicit bias continues to be a powerful and devastating issue that affects the way that the system is implemented and the way that decisions about punishment are made and in the way that juries are selected, and it influences both who is on death row, who is executed, who gets sentences. You know, I think one of the things you see is that kind of the devaluation and dehumanization of African American lives is particularly in stark relief when you look at kind of the race of victims and who gets executed. Because really, you know, about half of homicide victims are African American, but 77% of those executed are executed for killing someone who's white.
Sure.
And that, you know, and that's what's happened in Mr. Swain's case. And you see that play out in the cases and in choosing who is executed.
Well, I think Michelle Alexander puts that rather succinctly in her book, The New Jim Crow. The other thing is that Mr. Swain apparently was trialed in a rural county in Texas. And listening to my legal staff here, apparently folks could walk in and put all kinds of testimony where there had not previously been charges made. It was basically whatever somebody wanted to say was welcome to put in the record in this case. And then when the appellate courts look at it, they say, well, he has confessed, therefore he's guilty. I'm going to move on to the next case, which is perhaps something a little more productive to do. And Mr. Swain gets lost in the shuffle. I'm not saying that Mr. Swain is not guilty. I'm just saying that I am shocked that in a capital case, a case dealing with somebody's life or death, you can put extraneous evidence on where there has of previous crimes where there were no previous charges and therefore no litigation of those accusations. Is that normal?
Well, I think there are different rules that apply, and what's normal is probably, I guess, a relative term in some ways. I know that one of the other issues in his case was allegations of discriminatory jury selection. And one thing that isn't talked about a lot is, and when we talk about diversity, both diversity in jurors and having a diverse jury and what that means. We often talk about the rights of defendants and the rights of juries, but kind of in the context of what you're talking about, what we have seen and what studies have shown is that, in fact, diverse juries are better at decision making. And so they're better at parsing through the evidence that's presented and weighing it and finding the missing holes, that they deliberate longer, that they're better able to evaluate the evidence. They have fewer inaccuracies. And so we actually find that more diverse juries and juries that aren't all white are actually better performing juries.
One thing we need to correct, though, Ray, in this case, I've read both the Fifth Circuit cases and the case of the Court of Criminal Appeals. There never was a Batson issue raised.
Now, they didn't raise a Batson issue.
There was a Batson issue raised in this case. Now, they're very well. And see, the problem I have is when you pick a death penalty jury, especially in Texas, it's very, very difficult. And I wish somebody would educate our African American community. Most of them disqualify because they won't give the death penalty. And that's one of our big problems. You may have a large array of African Americans come to a jury panel. When you start questioning them, they just simply say, I can't give the death penalty. They're excused. And that's a major problem. Have you ever picked a case in a death penalty case and tried to do that?
No, I'm not discounting that at all. I was just going to say that I do believe there was actually, this is actually a jury shuffle case. So there was a Batson claim.
There was a jury shuffle, but it wasn't over the shuffle, not over a Batson.
Yes.
It's shuffling. Let me explain what a shuffling means to our listening
audience. Does the prosecutor get the same right to shuffle as the defense?
Either side can shuffle.
Yes.
And you don't have to give a reason for it. And they raised an issue that it was an improper shuffle because they wanted apparently more white people toward the front of the panel than the back of the panel. And that was the only issue. But then never after that, they never pursued a Batson claim.
Well, before we get off of this, will somebody, either Ms. Steinberg or Jim, explain to me, what happens when you get a shuffle?
What happens, they bring you in randomly, then you crash a shuffle, and they literally, if you have jury information cards, they cut them back up, throw them in a hat, and redraw them again and reseat the panel.
Okay, so it's a draw out of a hat situation.
Basically, right. Okay. They just reshuffle them. The shuffle means exactly that.
Okay. Joanna, is that your understanding?
That's my understanding. I'm certainly not an expert in a Texas case. That's my understanding, and my understanding is in this case, when the panel initially was seated, there were, 27% of the kind of first half of the jurors were people of color, and maybe half of that, there was a significantly lower proportion in the second half. So by kind of shuffling the jury, the first people that you're going to question might be less, were less diverse in the beginning. Like the first people they're choosing from. That's
okay.
Not the most articulate way of explaining
Susan
that.
Susan wanted to weigh in here.
I wanted to ask Jim a question. Okay, both sides, both the defense and the prosecution, would be able to ask for a shuffle.
One shuffle each, right.
Okay. So say the defense asks for a shuffle. Say they do a shuffle. People are shuffled. And then say the prosecutor perhaps doesn't like the way the shuffle comes out. Then they can ask for a shuffle.
Generally don't do that.
Okay.
The judges won't permit it in Texas.
Okay. All right.
Okay,
that's
so there's only one shuffle.
Judges are generally
for them to fight over,
shuffle,
right? Okay.
Sometimes you can rest a shuffle and be worse off when you start it.
Well, apparently that turned out to be that way right. In this case.
Because there are a problem regardless. In a death penalty, you don't pick a jury. You don't really bring in a panel of like 200 people. You bring them in small panels at a group and question them individually in Texas. So it's not like a typical jury panel where you bring in 60 or 70 people.
I know
you look them over.
Judge Ruben Guerrero had 150 in the panel for the cop case recently.
Right.
And they certainly couldn't get all that people into the courtroom, so they
right.
had to bring them in smaller groups.
Right. Well, in a death penalty case, they usually bring them in panels of about 12 each. So I get, but first of all, bring a whole bunch of people in. You can see the whole panel to begin with. Then they start bringing them off in sections of like 12 at whack because it takes several weeks to pick a jury, so they're going to have people sitting there for 12 weeks.
Ms. Steinberg, do you deal with these cases at the appellate level?
We deal with cases at post-conviction, yes, exactly.
And you do that?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't have an extensive Texas,
Texas is not your part of the territory.
No, we do have cases
in Texas. Give my sympathy.
My colleagues have cases in Texas.
Yeah, give my sympathy to your colleagues in Texas because I've been here all my life and I still find it frustrating. So where is most of your practice?
We do have cases in Texas. We now represent Dwayne Buck, who is mm-hmm. a Texas case. But I also have cases in Arkansas, in Louisiana. And actually, I did have another Texas case that we just settled, and we've had Pennsylvania, but it varies. There's four attorneys in our entire project here. And we do other non-capital work as well.
Well, after 30 years of doing the prison show here on KPFT and moving over to do Execution Watch, it's a show that only comes on when they're killing somebody. My replacement on the prison show is exoneree Anthony Graves, who was on death row for 12 years, locked up for a total of 14 and a half. And he was completely innocent. He didn't know the victims. He didn't know the perpetrators at all. He didn't know anything about the crime. And Houston prosecutor, what was his name, the last one that left in information?
Chuck Rosenthal.
Yeah.
Said of Anthony's case, oh, it's easy to convict somebody that's completely innocent because they don't even know where we get the story wrong. And I find such a statement shocking when we're talking about human life. And for years I've said, let's let them get the traffic cases, the red lights and the stop lights and the no signal left turn things out of the way. And when you get that down well, then you can start talking about taking parts of people's liberty. And then when you get that all straightened out, then you might consider human life. But they're in a rush to try that municipal court demeanor in capital cases. And I want you to tell your colleagues that we here on Execution Watch genuinely appreciate what you're doing. In the name of justice, and I appreciate you for being part of Execution Watch tonight.
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind, and we certainly share our appreciation with you for having the show and hosting the show and making sure that the stories are told.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Jim?
Yes. Michael is one of the more interesting things.
Mike?
Because when they're talking about the jury shuffle, really that never was an issue beyond the Texas courts, and everybody's brought up during the writ hearings. What they really talked about in the prior and post-conviction writs and appeals were the different confessions given. And that's one of the more interesting
things. Yeah, I can imagine Antonin Scalia sitting in the courthouse, the Supreme Court building tonight. Telephone comes in and they say, well, this issue and that issue, and he's out, but the guy confessed three times.
It's four. Well, he made four statements.
Four statements in implications. He confessed four times. I don't know where we need to go much further than that. And I just don't see. And you got to understand, when I was before the Supreme Court, I got Antonin Scalia's vote. So I'm certainly not down on the man. But when it comes to capital punishment, I think he's trying to get to that, you know, next bottle of wine.
Well, Michael's the one that discussed all the confessions. I thought those were interesting.
Michael, you want to wade into that at all?
Well, the interesting part about this case is this man convicted himself. I'm not saying the only evidence, but the main evidence was his own confession. You have a confession that he made before he was in custody that he admitted to a burglary. Once he admitted the burglary, he was put into custody, he was Mirandized, and then he admitted the burglary but said somebody else did it. They then
Michael, be sure and mention that he admitted the burglary but said there was a killing during the burglary.
That's
he admitted
correct.
That, but he just denied doing the killing.
His partner did it.
Right.
But once they talked to the partner had an alibi. So they came back to him again, Mirandized him again, and he has another partner. They talked to that partner, and that partner's got an alibi. So now you have multiple confessions, each one with a Miranda warning, and each one he talks anyway, but each one is wrong. So we have two confessions without Miranda before he was in custody, then two confessions with Miranda when he was in custody. They now take him before a magistrate to give him his legal warnings about having an attorney, the right to remain silent. He gets to court and he asks for an attorney. Now, the testimony shows that this man was a big fan of Law and Order, big fan of CSI. He liked watching cop shows. All cop shows talk about Miranda. Once Miranda is exercised, you want a lawyer, you have to be quiet. The moment he gets out of court and he says he wants a lawyer, they take him out and start talking to him again. Most people do not understand that issue. We think that once you want a lawyer, it's to be no more talking. But what happens in this case is he was arrested on a burglary.
Yeah.
The lawyer had to do with the burglary. Once that was taken care of, they started talking about the person. And the truth becomes the police are in a tough situation. They do not know she's deceased yet. They just know she's missing, and they're trying to find her. She might be hurt someplace. She might be tied up someplace. They're talking to him, and so he leads it to the body. Once he leads it to the body, they Mirandize him again, and he gives a full confession.
Do you know who this sounds like? This sounds like Henry Lee Lucas. You know, Henry Lee Lucas was convicted in Texas and literally on death's door. He was waiting for his execution date. And Jim Maddox went to the governor, George Bush, and said, we can't kill this man. And George Bush said, why the hell can we? He said, he's also convicted of a murder the same day within like 20 minutes in South Florida.
Several hundred miles away.
And so they send somebody and talk to Henry Lucas and say, well, wait a minute. We're fixing to kill you for this Texas murder, and within 20 minutes of that murder, you're also convicted of a murder in South Florida. How does that work? And he said, have you ever watched Star Trek?
And Henry Lee's claim is a part of Star Trek.
Yes, it was getting materialized here and materialized there. The man was crazy, obviously. But he was very good at giving confections. Because all they had to do is give him a little hint. And Henry Lee was an artist. And he could visualize things. And so if you give him a hint, he'd start visualizing. And he'd give you a detailed confession of what happened, even though there's no way in hell he could have been there. Henry Lee Lucas, at the top of his career, was convicted of 17 murders. And the only one we think he actually did was he killed his mother. who probably deserved killing.
Should have been killed before he was born, maybe.
That might have been,
might have been better.
But Henry was exonerated and died of cancer.
But the difference in this case, though, Ray, we didn't have multiple murders. We got multiple people committing one murder. Initially blamed man number one, alibi. Then he blamed man number two, alibi. Then after that didn't work, he said, well, I finally fessed up, I did it. So we have one murder, but multiple people doing it.
So there's a pattern to his trail.
Right.
But, you know, I'm somewhat concerned about this fascination for crime and justice television shows and movies, because if someone is driven by an abnormal imagination, they can make themselves a star in one of those movies.
You know what's been interesting about that, Ray? What's been interesting about that, the state's been the one most concerned about the CSI programs, because they're so expecting the prosecution with these marvelous things that the state doesn't do it. They don't want to convict. And the prosecutors are the ones who are complaining, because when they're picking a jury nowadays, they want to make certain, because, you know, the idea that the lab can do all these wonderful things is pure Hollywood. And people expect that when they go to the courthouse. That doesn't happen that way. And the prosecution's the ones worried about the impact of the CSI, because they're expecting all these marvelous scientists to come down, and they don't have them. It's all poppycock.
Yeah, that's all poppycock.
Of course it is.
I anguish over this show a little bit. I don't like doing them. Tonight has not been pleasant from a technical standpoint, and I've got to straighten all that out so that I don't get into that trap again. This is a relatively uncomplicated situation.
Well, let me tell you what makes it, and I wanted Susan to speak on this, if you don't mind. The thing that hurt him more than anything, the real bad part of this case was punishment, because what happened... everybody, when they think of a movie, when you think of something horrible happens, get in a car and someone's in the back seat waiting for you, and it's a man attacking a woman.
Scary, scary.
And I want Susan to kind of talk about that from a female viewpoint, the impact that would have on a jury for the future dangerousness part, because it was all women victims that testified.
Yeah, but that there were no charges in that case, and then
well, they might not have caught him until then. That's
I know, but don't you think that this stuff needs to go through some kind of judicial process?
Here's the big joke they do, Ray. They tell the jury, and this is one of those law wink things, they tell the jury, before you can consider this unadjudicated defense, you've got to believe beyond a reasonable doubt this person did it. Now, they'll give that instruction, wink, wink.
Wink, wink.
But you
wink,
have,
wink, nod, nod,
when you
snicker,
have,
snicker.
When you hear three women in a row come and say that he hid in the back seat of my car, knocked out the dome line, hit me with the stun gun, and then you hear another woman come in and says, well, he was used to be my girlfriend. She put a rag over my mouth and chloroformed me and knocked me out. When you hear four of these women testify, that jury instruction becomes kind of silly at that point, because the total number, and you're in East Texas, don't forget. There were guys tip their hats and say, yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am, no, ma'am.
Don't cuss in front of them.
Yeah, right.
And get that group of women
you're talking about Aunt B stuff here.
I'm talking about Aunt B stuff, and you got those folks sitting on the jury and say, what bothers me a lot? And you try a case like that, and I guarantee you, the lawyers that picked this jury had one hell of a time getting African Americans on the jury, because they'll always disqualify themselves.
Yeah, that would be a problem. Let me
it's a
see.
Big problem.
Let me see who we got on the telephone. Hello, this is Ray. Is this Gloria?
In the killing capital of the country.
She's also leading a demonstration. Gloria, are you there?
Yeah, let me turn off the mic.
Okay. No, we appreciate your work in that regard. It's nice to listen in as you talk to the crowd. Speaking of crowds, how many folks you got there tonight?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 of us.
Okay,
including Mr. Price, and he's got two film students from the University of Southern California with him who are doing a documentary.
Okay, good.
So, I'll be glad when next week is over, because there's no more scheduled after that for this year. But tonight, Mario Swain was executed. My condolences to all of his friends on death row.
Did he have any family witnesses?
No. I found out he did have witnesses. I don't know who they were. But there was nobody at the hospitality house. And apparently the main family he has is two older grandparents who just weren't able to make the trip. So I'm not sure. I was looking. I thought no witnesses had gone in because I was looking for African-American people. But there was a second group that went in.
Yeah, and spiritual advisor and some others. Mario Swain died essentially alone in a Texas prison with people that he met after he got to Texas prison.
Right. So I want to thank y'all for doing the show. I hope that the guys on death row are listening. And like I say, I send my condolences to all of you who are friends with Mario. And next week, Ramon Hernandez is set for Wednesday. And then on Thursday, an innocent man, Preston Hughes, is set for execution. And if you want to check out his case, if you have a computer, it's go to the Skeptical Juror. And the HPD crime lab, run by a bunch of gangster criminals, was responsible for him being sent to death.
Do you have a date on Preston?
Yeah, next Thursday, the 15th.
Okay, the 14th, we have scheduled Ramon Hernandez.
Yeah, Ramon Hernandez is on Wednesday and Preston Hughes is on Thursday.
Okay, Gloria, give our regards to the other vigilants there.
Okay, thanks, you guys.
Thank you. And when does the next time that abolition movement meets?
Well, we just met Tuesday, and we had a really good meeting. Our next meeting is December 4th, I believe, which is the first Tuesday of December. And that's when we have our holiday card signing.
Card signing, yeah.
People bring food and refreshments, and we have a more fun time amid the killing that goes on in this damn state. So I invite people to come out to Shade Center on Tuesday, December 4th. We're going to start a little early at 6 o'clock and try to get all 295, I think, cards signed. Plus, we also send them to the 28 juveniles who were taken off death row.
Okay, Gloria, thank you very much. Appreciate all that you do.
And we have a new website. I mean, it's the same address, but it's our friends in the Netherlands have updated it, and it's abolitionmovement.org. And if Petra in the Netherlands is listening, thank you, dear.
That's exactly what I was fixing to say next, and I'll say it anyway. You can keep up with Gloria and organizational efforts in abolitionmovement.org exactly that way. Spell it out. Abolitionmovement.org. Thank you, Gloria.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
And if you want to keep up with Dave Atwood and his efforts, you can check out, and that's at TCADP.org. That's Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty, just the first letters, .org. Check it out. And my name is Ray Hill, and we've been doing Execution Watch here on radio station KPFT in Houston. And I've still got the legal team around the table. Is there? We've been talking pretty scattered all over the place, but there wasn't a lot to talk about in this case except the exceptions. You know, what is it?
We might add in that when the women testify against him or the witnesses who testify at the punishment stage of other bad acts, that they can be cross-examined by defense counsel if defense counsel chooses, right?
Yeah, but, you know, if you're sitting there in defense counsel and your client is going down the tubes fast, why would you want to make these women mad at you?
That is correct. I mean, obviously,
I mean, you're a defense lawyer. Right. You're in the courtroom trying to...
Obviously, you know, every situation is different, different witnesses, different bad acts they may be testifying to. There may be circumstances where a defense lawyer would want to cross-examine them. There may be circumstances, obviously, where the defense lawyer wouldn't want to cross-examine them.
Sure.
I mean, that would be a determination that the trial lawyer would have to make.
What do you do? Say you're the defense lawyer in this case. And you're in a rural Texas county. You're not in sophisticated Harris County courthouse, depending that is the appropriate word to apply to Texas criminal courthouse. But you're out in the boonies somewhere.
Behind the piney wood curtain.
Where the sheriff knows half the jury and the prosecutor knows the rest of them. What do you do?
I mean, in this case, there are actually a number of additional women that we didn't that also testified to other bad acts that we didn't have the time to go in. And if you have that many acts, witnesses testifying to other attacks. In any event, wherever you are, people are going to certainly
believe.
Can
you challenge this?
Let me tell you
what, can you challenge this in front of the judge?
Let me make a suggestion to you. And I've done this before, and I'm not advocating that everybody do this. But a number of years ago, to give you a good example, I ended up in Ozona, Texas, and I had to try a case out there.
I spent about a week there one day.
I spent a week there 1 hour. So I ended up in Ozona, Texas, trying this case involving a bunch of drugs, and my client was a worn-out gal out of Montrose area. And the major part of the voir dire was prosecutor talking about Houston like it was Flame. He'd say, from Houston lawyer, he had the horrible things. And on the jury panel was the coach of the highway patrolman that arrested my client, a junior high coach. And on the jury panel was another man who was had been his high school coach. And those line dogs sat there, lying through their teeth, saying they could be fair and objective. And it was obvious they were very hostile toward me because I happened to be from Houston. And I tell you exactly what I did. When people start acting that way, the worst thing you can do, and people know they're not acting fair, is to let them take advantage. And you know what I did? I got up and said, it's real obvious you don't like me because I don't happen to live in Ozona. It's obvious the way you're acting. And it's also obvious the way you're acting is I think you're lying through your teeth. There's no way in the world you can coach a guy in high school and say you can be objective about him testifying. I said, I've got a real good idea. The way you're acting, there's a tree in front of the courthouse. Let's just lynch her now. Why don't we get it over with? Why bother with this farce of a trial? And I yelled at them and chewed them out. And at that point, they backed down because at that point, they got defensive thinking.
Well, all that was on the record.
Absolutely, it's on the record. And at that point, I challenged them and I said, I don't think you're. And I told the two coaches who testified, they said, and I said, you said under oath that you could be honest. I said, you know as well as I do, you're not telling the truth. You know that's not fair. And what happened at that point, they got not defensive in the right word, but I challenged them because they knew they were fudging on me. And when people know they're fudging on you and you challenge them, lots of times they will back down. They did, and they all backed down. And we got along real well after that. Once we got that little yell, in fact, the judge.
They still hung her.
Of course they hung her, but they didn't hang her. They hung her very nicely, though. They didn't hang her as bad as it would have been, but you cannot.
Fur-lined noose.
When you go into those real hostile situations like that, you cannot let that go unmentioned. And again, I'm a great believer in a complete honest and candor when you're talking to people and selecting a jury. And if I think someone's not telling the truth, I'll tell them.
Well.
And see, the problem we got here, the real problem is that it terrifies every woman on the jury, plus you got these East Texas princes that want to protect women.
I remember when Dennis lady killed her husband with a Mercedes. You remember that?
When it went over in there. She went over a couple of times to park
several
by accident. What is accidental?
And her defense lawyer was able to get it down to one time, running over with a Mercedes. Said, you made your point with one time instead of showing her moving forward, running over, backing up, running over, moving forward five or six times. You can challenge that, but that probably wouldn't work in the equivalent of Ozona, Texas.
Well, it sort of worked a little bit, but not real well.
Okay.
It wasn't as bad as it would have been if I had to keep my mouth shut, I'll tell you.
I think that was Galveston County where they tried that.
No, they tried it here in Houston. Clearly. I think George Parnum represented
George
her.
George Parnum. He got it down to one running over.
Well, he said that. I don't think the jury bought it. The big problem with that case, and George did a good job on it, she was kind of an arrogant. You know, a lot of these people from South America get kind of prissy, and she's pretty prissy and arrogant.
The defendants don't help themselves. You've been listening to Execution Watch here on radio station KPFT today. November the, what is the 6th, 7th, 8th? What is today?
8th.
8th, 2012. Mario Swain is dead. He was alive when we started the show. And now the show's over, and state of Texas has killed him. Normally, if he had any family, they would have shipped his body over to a little Baptist church around the corner from the prison so the family could feel the body while it still had some warmth in it, because as long as you're on death row, you cannot be touched by an outside human being, not even your mother. That's a ritual that you go through, and we go through this ritual next week. We're supposed to go through it twice. We hope that there are two stays. We'd rather not do a show at all. Fellers on the row, I hope somebody will shoot me a kite and let me know what you thought about Mario. because I've only had one side of the picture here. We go here from what is in the court record and what is in the media at the time of the trials and the investigation. We don't have any other material to go by. Gloria tonight talked about how many people have been killed and under what circumstances and what happens when the 10 next people get killed. But Mario Swain was a human being who was alive less than an hour ago. Texas does this very regularly. Some of us are trying to organize a march on Washington against mass incarceration, and I'm sure that in that process we're going to cover execution issues. I got an email from a loving mother this afternoon saying, "What can I do to stop the law of parties under which my son is about to be executed?" A lot of stuff crosses over my transom, and I'm not a lawyer, and very thankful that I'm not a lawyer. I can't do anything about it. My role is to answer the phone and listen to what the folks say and help those I can and comfort those that I can't. That's the role of an activist in this business. Guys, I hope we stop doing this. As Gloria reported, there is some movement in that direction. I hope that comes while you're still breathing, and I hope some of you will get exonerated and come out. In the meantime, I'm glad that you can now hear Execution Watch, and I'm glad that you can hear The Prison Show with a stronger signal there on Death Row, because KPFT had the foresight to get a repeater in Goodrich, Texas. I want to thank Mike. Mike, thanks for coming in and helping us with that. We miss Larry. Larry's got a lay-in tonight. For those of you who go to prison know what a lay-in is, and he'll be back for future shows. I want to thank Susan. Susan, thank you very much for coming into the show. Jim, you saved my life. You not only are here and have done all this research. But as soon as I get I get some money, I'll have some made.
Some Ray Lash buttons.
Jim Skelton is the backbone of the show. I'm just the host. We have Doyle's not here. We've got a new engineer tonight, and we appreciate his efforts here at KPFD. And it's good to have Mike out there. I've got Mike out there in the engineering team, and thank you all very much. Excuse my criticism earlier for that. The music, if we had some, would be from Victoria Panetti of She Monster International, and Here She Comes. My name is Ray Hill. This has been Execution Watch on KPFT Houston. Good night.